It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For more than two decades, Pittsburgh has regularly made various most livable city lists that include categories, features such as stability, healthcare, education, culture. But what about accessibility for people with disabilities trying to navigate sidewalks, entranceways? Joining us in studio is Heather Tomko, a public health researcher and founder of Accessible Universe, which advocates improving inclusion of people with physical disabilities. And Accessible Universe is spelled YOUNIVERSE. Heather, welcome to the Confluence.
Hi, thanks so much for having me today.
For those who don't know, last summer you were crowned Ms. Wheelchair USA. What did that do to start or maybe intensify your advocacy work?
It was a product of really great timing for me. It came into my life when I was starting to formalize my advocacy. I've always been an advocate just out of necessity, mm-hmm. because otherwise I wouldn't get accommodations that I needed. But I was starting to realize that if I really wanted to see large-scale change, I needed to start advocating for more than just the things in my own life. Mm-hmm. And a friend actually found the pageant online and emailed it to me, and I loved that they were doing such a big part of it was an emphasis on advocacy. And so it's really helped to expand my reach and my voice and really broaden the scale of the work that I've been doing.
So it gave you, in a sense, more gravitas, if
yes.
you would, for someone, if you hadn't won that title, it gave you more of a platform?
Definitely. I would still be doing what I'm doing with or without the crown, but it's definitely given me a little more legitimacy and just ability to reach out and talk to people that maybe I wouldn't have access to otherwise.
And how important is that? Because you said you would be having to do it and you were doing it yourself because you were doing it for yourself. There's, you know, is there really anybody out there doing this or that has a strong enough voice?
There are definitely people out there, but I think it's hard to get your voice heard. Social media has actually done a lot to help expand the voices of people with disabilities because it's let us be heard in places we might otherwise not be able to for very real physical reasons. And so that has been really great. But I think there isn't a large, widespread movement still. There's a lot of individual players doing really important things, but it's still kind of ramping up and getting that momentum to turn into a widespread movement.
Right. One more question about the pageant. You, as part of the competition, you gave a platform speech. What was your platform then, and have you incorporated that into your advocacy work since then?
I absolutely have. My platform was increasing inclusion for people with disabilities into their communities, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it essentially is what I've been doing with Accessible Universe. I think it's important that we look beyond strict following of the Americans with Disabilities Act and look at inclusion in general, because there's the law and the strict guidelines that it sets out, and then there's looking more fully at, do people with disabilities have the same opportunities and access that people without disabilities do?
What do you mean by inclusion? Because there's the inclusion, the physical inclusion, physically being able to access a place, and then there's the inclusion of your thoughts and needs and ideas to help fulfill those needs.
Absolutely. So I think a really good way to look at it is that under the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, an entrance for someone with a wheelchair might be around the corner, down an alley. Maybe you have to go through the kitchen of a restaurant to get to your table. That's legal. That's allowed. And technically, I am included. but I don't really feel valued when I'm first down an alley around a corner and told I have to go in the separate, kind of often sketchy way, because they didn't really think about people like me at the beginning. It really makes me feel like I'm an afterthought. They're letting me come, but they don't really care if I'm there or not.
Okay. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Heather Tomko, a public health researcher and founder of Accessible Universe. We're talking about improving inclusion of people with physical disabilities. You recently wrote a first-person essay for Public Source in which you say you've had to learn to get around in a city. You mentioned a couple of the examples. That is not very accessible to you. So how does that inaccessibility manifest itself? Can you give us some other ideas? Some things we just don't think about, or at least I don't think about, but you have to think about every single day.
Yes. I think the number one thing that people don't realize is the amount of logistical planning that goes into every single decision that I make. I can't just, you know, decide to go out to dinner or pop into a coffee shop. I need to make sure I call ahead and know that it's accessible. I need to make sure they have an accessible restroom, because the two are not the same. Right. There can be one without the other. I need to know that I have an easy way of transportation. Uber and Lyft are not accessible here in Pittsburgh, so ride sharing isn't even an option for me. If there's street parking, I need to make sure there's an accessible street parking right. space. Street or garage, they're both very limited. And so it's just all these planning steps ahead of time before I even get to my destination. Whereas someone without a disability would just go.
We were talking about and referencing the Americans with Disabilities Act. That was passed by Congress in 1990, prohibiting discrimination in employment, public services, public accommodations, and telecommunications. Is the pivotal word in the law reasonable, as in reasonable accommodations? It's kind of vague, isn't it?
It's incredibly vague. And it manifests in a way that business owners or landlords don't know what they need to do to meet the law. And often they don't realize they're afoul of the ADA until they have a complaint made against them. So you're really catching them off guard later, and then they get defensive, understandably, because as far as they know, they are in compliance with the law. But it's so situational that it's really hard to apply broadly.
You said something very important: until a complaint is filed. So is there no enforcement prior to the complaint? No checkup to see if they are compliant?
There's absolutely no enforcement.
The onus is on you?
It is. It puts the burden on the person with a disability to make that complaint. You can file a federal civil rights complaint with the Department of Justice, or you can try to talk to the business owner directly and let them know. But at that point, it's too late. Mm-hmm. It's much harder to make changes after the fact than if the changes had been made earlier in the process.
We have a lot of older buildings in this city, some very beautiful old buildings. But they're not exempt from this. They weren't grandfathered into the ADA, are they?
Correct. It's a really common misconception that there is a grandfathering clause in the ADA. There is the kind of out in the reasonable exception. Some of these old buildings, there might not be a reasonable way to make them accessible. But many of them, there is a way. And because they think they're exempt, because they think the fact that they were constructed before the ADA means they're fine, and it does not.
The city, the Urban Redevelopment Authority, seemed to be trying to enhance accessibility through the One Step program. Briefly, what would that do, and where is it?
So the One Step program is an initiative to help businesses who have a single step at the for entry, one barrier to get into their business. It's an initiative that helps them change that into a ramp. I think it's a really important program. We have a lot of businesses with a single step, but it still takes about a year from start to finish, even with the kind of expedited help that the initiative supports. And it's a lot of time and effort that business owners don't necessarily think is a priority when they're planning out their next year.
Okay, final quick question. Accessible Universe is participating in the Inclusive Innovation Summit this month. In a sentence or two, what are you hoping to get out of this summit, your participation in?
So Accessible Universe will be at two different events. The first is the Silent Disco at the Children's Museum, which we're very excited about because it shows that people with disabilities can have fun and who are just like everyone else. And then we'll also be doing an event on Saturday talking about what I talked about here, how you need to go beyond the ADA for people with disabilities.
Very good. Heather Tomko is a public health researcher and founder of Accessible Universe, that's spelled YOUNIVERSE, which advocates improving the inclusion of people with physical disabilities. Heather, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Access to birth control and other reproductive health care services can be difficult for low-income Pennsylvanians. That's especially so for those in more rural parts of the state. Now it can get even harder under a new rule from the Trump administration. Then, the proposed federal budget prioritizes $111 million to complete repairs to the locks and dams on the lower Monongahela River. We'll hear from a group of river transportation experts about how they plan to use the new funding. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, English novelist Charles Dickens visits the city in 1842. Dickens and his wife were traveling the United States and arrived in Pittsburgh in March via the Pennsylvania Canal Aqueduct over the Allegheny River. While in town, he stayed at the Exchange Hotel and was visited by prominent locals, including William Foster and his son and future American musician, Stephen. He also visited the Western Pennsylvania Penitentiary, where some scholars believe he had the inspiration for many of the conditions he mentioned in his classic, A Christmas Carol. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Allegheny County Council is considering an ordinance that would ban mental health care professionals from providing so-called conversion therapy to minors. Conversion therapy aims to change a queer person's sexuality to straight, or to convince someone who is transgender that their actual gender is the one that was assigned to them at birth. 90.5 WESA Sarah Bowden spoke with Dr. Alex Kahn, a pediatrician and president of the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities. The society does not have an official position on conversion therapy, but Kahn says the practice should be prohibited.
There's a lot of data that shows that conversion therapy doesn't work and does not lead to people having a change in sexual orientation or gender identity. And there is a lot of data that suggests that it can be extremely harmful, especially to children. So personally, I strongly oppose conversion therapy in all of its forms.
What are some of those harms?
Well, we know a lot of people who go through conversion therapy end up with significant depression, some of them even with suicidal ideation, and some commit suicide, which is a big problem, obviously. those that don't have severe depression can still have major problems with intimacy and sexual dysfunction. There can be a loss of spiritual or religious comfort, and that can be very distressing to a lot of patients as well. And this can last for years, if not an entire lifetime.
What is it about conversion therapy that creates these results?
Well, a lot of people do conversion therapy differently, but there's a general way that people seem to approach it that convinces people who are going through conversion therapy that what they're doing is wrong, that their feelings are somehow wrong or abnormal. And these are very deeply held feelings that people have that are clearly immutable in most cases. And that can be extremely damaging to people.
Regarding parental rights, in some states, parents who are Jehovah's Witnesses aren't allowed to deny their children blood transfusions, even though their faith prohibits this practice. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that a state can determine when a child's welfare supersedes parental religious freedom. Unlike blood transfusions, conversion therapy is not life-saving medical care. So do you think it violates parental rights to ban conversion therapy, speaking again as a pediatrician?
I don't think it in any way does so, because we know that it doesn't work and doesn't change children's sexual orientation or gender orientation and self-assessment. Therefore, what we're really doing is protecting children who can't consent for themselves. It's clear that we need to not be doing this to children.
The proposed ban in Allegheny County only focuses on mental health care professionals, so conceivably, interventions could be provided by non-healthcare practitioners. Do you think the ban here in Allegheny County goes far enough?
I'm not sure if there's a way to ban it altogether. I would certainly favor that. But clearly, that raises some legal issues that are beyond my level of expertise.
Considering all the harms that conversion therapy can cause, what do you think motivates parents to send their kids to conversion therapy?
I think in general, parents really want what's best for their children. Parents love their children, and we know that in a lot of subcultures and communities in the U.S., people don't accept homosexuality and transgender, particularly in youth. And that can be extremely difficult for children and for families. So they opt for this intervention. The problem is we know that that's misinformation. We know that conversion therapy doesn't work and actually causes a lot of harm. So what we need to do is make sure that parents get the correct information, and we need to protect children so that they're not forced into these interventions that we know are harmful.
Dr. Alex Kahn is professor of pediatrics at UC San Diego and president of the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities. He spoke with WESA's Sarah Bowden. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Getting birth control, breast cancer screenings, and other reproductive health care services is already difficult for low-income Pennsylvanians in rural counties. It could get more difficult under a new rule from the Trump administration. 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins explains how.
Coffee is a key element of the morning.
Catherine Schott has a long drive ahead of her on a recent Friday morning. And that's not unusual. She's the lead clinician at Planned Parenthood of Western Pennsylvania. And while she's based in Pittsburgh, she often drives out to rural areas like Westmoreland and Cambria counties. That means an early alarm, lots of caffeine, and stuffing a big backpack full of everything she needs for the day.
I get teased for the size of my backpack, but I'm sort of a one-woman healthcare show, so it has computers and...
She sees patients who need birth control, screenings for sexually transmitted infections, breast cancer exams, and abortion services.
Gotta fit it all in here.
The Planned Parenthood in Johnstown is the only place in Cambria County where women can get that care for free or at a low cost. That's because providers like Planned Parenthood cluster around big cities like Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. Meanwhile, 14 rural counties have no low-cost clinics at all, according to the state attorney general's office.
We do just about anything on any given day when someone comes in and says they need it.
The cost of those services, other than abortion, is paid for by the federal Title X program. Under Title X, the government sets aside money to provide family planning and reproductive health care to low-income Americans. Pennsylvania has the third largest population that qualifies for Title X. But clinics across the state, including Cambria County, could lose that funding stream. Here's how. It's already illegal to use federal money to pay for abortions, but under a pending Trump administration rule, Title X clinics that perform abortions will lose the grant money for everything they do. They'd even be barred from telling women that they can get an abortion somewhere else. Gina D'Angelo is worried about what that would mean for women.
So a lot of folks are going to find themselves without a place to go.
She has firsthand experience with Title X. In her last semester of college, she found a lump on her breast.
And I freaked out. I was working as a bartender, working my way through school, and I just remember pacing back and forth behind the bar, wondering, like, what am I going to do?
Eventually, she found Planned Parenthood, where she got a free breast exam. They gave her a voucher for a diagnostic mammogram, and luckily, the lump was benign. D'Angelo was studying in Pittsburgh, where there are a lot of options. But she wonders what will happen in rural areas.
Are they going to take time off and try to travel to another town to see a doctor? Or are they going to just carry on, as I was very tempted to do, like nothing was wrong, because they weren't sure what to do about it?
You know, I think there are better ways to invest and care for women and families.
That's Dan Bartkowiak of the Pennsylvania Family Institute, which opposes abortion rights. He says women can go to community health centers instead. The centers receive federal funds to provide primary care in underserved areas. The state has nearly 250 of them. But Cambria and three other Pennsylvania counties don't have any, according to the Pennsylvania Association of Community Health Centers. Planned Parenthood is the only option in those counties.
Good afternoon, George Washington University Professor Sarah Rosenbaum's office.
Sarah Rosenbaum has done a lot of research on community health centers and Title X.
The rule is structured to completely reinvent the Title X provider network.
Rosenbaum believes the rule is meant to provide federal money to a new network of providers, including groups that are opposed to abortion.
So you could have sites that offer pills or condoms, and then a bunch of sites that are just doing abstinence.
Planned Parenthood says its doors will stay open no matter what, though they haven't figured out exactly how they'd make up for the lost funding. The group and state attorneys general, including Pennsylvania's Josh Shapiro, have already sued over the rule. Unless the courts intervene, it will go into effect on May 3rd. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out more about Buffy St. Marie. Growing up on a Cree First Nation reserve in Saskatchewan, Buffy St. Marie taught herself how to play guitar and piano. In 1964, she released her debut album, It's My Way, which included her protest song, Universal Soldier.
He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years.
St. Marie's advocacy for Indigenous people continued in her music and also moved to television when she appeared on Sesame Street from 1976 to 1981. Her songs have been performed by many, including Donovan, Janis Joplin, and Courtney Love. She co-wrote the song Up Where We Belong for the film An Officer and a Gentleman in 1982 and became the first Indigenous person to win an Oscar. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last year, President Donald Trump put a stop to the work on a much-needed but very expensive project to repair the locks and dams on the lower Monongahela River. That changed last week. The White House budget is proposing $111 million to work on the project. Joining us to discuss how that funding could affect one of Western Pennsylvania's most active waterways, Maryam Busey, Executive Director of the Port of Pittsburgh Commission, Peter Stefajic, Chairman and CEO of Campbell Transportation Company, and Steve Fritz, Mega Project Manager with the Army Corps of Engineers, Pittsburgh District. Welcome to you all.
Thank you,
Kevin.
Thank you. Good morning, Kevin.
To each of you, I want to start off with the news out of the White House last week. Surprised by it or not? Marianne, let's start with you and go around the table.
pleasantly surprised. It's great for this region that we were able to get the $111 million. Just note that out of that $111, $55 million comes from a trust fund that is funded by the commercial users of the inland waterways.
And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that trust fund and the use of the money. Steve, were you surprised?
Yeah, certainly. It was nice to see that. You know, the project started way back with authorization in 92. We've got our first construction funds in 1994. We thought 10 years of construction, we'd be out of it. And here we are almost, you know, 20 years, 25 years later, and we're finally getting completion funds for the project.
Let me do a quick update on that. In terms of, you said you thought you'd be done in 10 years.
Yes, sir.
Was that due to maybe not the funding coming like you thought, or more challenges in the work itself?
For the most part, it was the funding. There were challenges along the way that might have added a year to the contracts or to the project here or there, but for the most part, it was a funding challenge, not getting the funding for efficient construction.
Okay. Peter, surprised or not?
Yes, we were very surprised and also pleasantly surprised. And the exciting thing really is normally we do have to go through the appropriations process every year. Basically, we rely on Congress to appropriate the money 1 year at a time. The nice thing about this $111 million number in the budget is it's to completion, which means that it'll be a multi-year funding, and it'll hopefully get this project across the goal line. So we're very excited about it.
All right, so we're going to talk about the project, what's going to be done. But, Steve, I'm going to rely on you to give us sort of a brief status update of the condition of these particular facilities.
All right. Well, back in the late 80s, it was determined there was a condition problem at all three facilities on the Lower Mon, at Braddock, Elizabeth, and at Charleroi.
Okay.
So we embarked on a feasibility study to determine what's the best solution to recapitalize those facilities. And that came out that we were going to build a new dam at Braddock, which is there by Kennywood, eliminate Lock and Dam 3 at Elizabeth, and then replace the locks up at Charleroi. And again, it's all condition-driven. We realized that the life of these facilities was at its end, and in order to continue to serve the nation and the region, we needed to recapitalize. So the condition was really the driver.
Okay. At its end, but you sort of have to look into the future. You can't say, oh, it's going to end in 6 months. That's too late to project that. Is that correct? I mean, in a sense, like, to address the actual issue. You have to project when you need the replacement years in
advance. Yes, that's exactly right. And we had estimated that we needed that replacement to be done, you know, maybe 15 years ago. Now, you know, and some of the stuff that we thought of, you know, we'd look at the condition of things as time goes on. And we looked at the lock and dam at Elizabeth, Pennsylvania, for instance, and we thought that there would be some issues with the dam there. And there was. Back in 2007, we had to spend a lot of operations and maintenance money to fix that dam because it was in a failing condition. Now that, you know, $6 or $7 million we spent to fix that dam, that could have went to some other needy project within the portfolio of the Corps of Engineers to help them, you know, continue to navigate with efficiency and reliability. But because our project wasn't funded on time, we had to spend additional money to fix that facility.
All right. Marianne, as leader of the Port of Pittsburgh Commission, and Peter, as, you know, as a transportation provider, as a business person that uses the rivers, have the current condition of the facilities that are going to be renovated with the approval of this money, have they hampered? How have they impacted the river commercial traffic? Peter, let's start with you. I'm sorry. Yeah, Peter, let's start with you.
Yeah, well, right now, I'd just like to add to what Steve
sure.
said, that the at Lock 3 at Elizabeth, though, that facility was built in the about 1905. Was started construction, was completed in 1907. So we're looking at a facility that's still built on wooden foundations. And, you know, and without this, these systems, you know, the Monongahela River, as we all know, from General Braddock crossing it, would be, you know, in the summer about 18 inches deep. So it's absolutely essential for navigation. So what's happened here is that we've had tremendous operational delays getting through these structures during the construction period and also going through Elizabeth, which is only three barges at a time. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we've experienced a lot of costs and a lot of delays, you know, as the construction has been going on for the last couple of decades.
Marianne?
Well, I can say, you got to congratulate the Corps on putting bandages on, repairs that need to be done in these locks and dams. But when you have an unscheduled closure, a scheduled closure people can plan for, not that it's not costly, it is, but you're getting some unscheduled closures. You know, we had a lock in our district that had the most lock closures last year in the whole country. And there's no place for these barges to go. It's not like you're at a toll road or you can take a side road like on a highway. You're sitting and you're waiting, whether it be days, weeks, a month. And that's very costly to the end user. It's costly to the barge operator. And it's costly to the person that's shipping the product out. So it, from an economic standpoint, it's pretty devastating.
Well, you've mentioned more than 100 years old. People can grasp that. So they've existed beyond their projected lifespan?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. Yeah, much beyond their projected lifespan. And they've undergone some rehabilitations at various stages in their lifespan. Mm-hmm. But the whole idea is that we have a pretty robust operation and maintenance program where we go out and we do condition assessments of the critical facilities, the critical components within those facilities, and determine, rack and stack those, if you will, to determine what priorities do we need to place on replacing different critical pieces of infrastructure. And then that goes to our division, and then that goes nationwide, and then the priority is given out in the president's budget as well as our O&M program.
So if you are a glass half full, or maybe in this case a lock half full person, do you say that they've more than met their intended purpose, Peter?
Well, they've absolutely. I mean, they've exceeded their intended purpose. I believe the design life was 50 years, Steve, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct, Peter.
Originally, and here we are up past 100 years. You know, and at some point, from a taxpayer perspective, we're looking to put O&M and maintenance money into a structure that really should have been replaced. I use the analogy of your old car. You know, at some point, it just doesn't make sense to keep. I mean, you can keep it running, but at some points, it doesn't make sense. You're better off getting a new one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about the impact of the proposed $111 million in federal funding to upgrade locks and dams on the Lower Mon. We mentioned the $111 million. About half of that is coming from the trust fund. That comes from revenues from a diesel tax. Is that correct?
Okay. That's correct.
That's correct.
Could more be used from that fund to maybe more immediately address some issues that are out there?
Yes.
What do you think, Marianne?
Yes. The trust fund collects anywhere between $115 and $120 million per year. So at the very minimum, you could do $240 million worth of construction per year. And the commercial users, that's about 400 industries across the country that pay in, they're the only people that pay into these capital development projects, which is defined as anything over $20 million, I believe, Steve. So we want to make sure that every penny of tax that is paid is put toward these projects, because there is a capital development plan. You know, the Port of Pittsburgh is part of a 12,000 navigable mile system, and so there are locks and dams throughout the system that need repairs and need projects done. So we need to spend every penny that we put into the trust fund to keep those projects going. Now, full and efficient funding to keep four or five projects going at one time and get all 25 projects off the list in 20 years is about $400 million. And we were able to kind of maintain that for the last 5 years because we changed the parameters on Olmsted, which was the number one project, to 8515.
Mm-hmm. Peter, Steve, do you think that maybe freeing up some additional money from the surplus might be a good investment early on? You're using more, but would that investment maybe stave off costlier repairs in the future? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of our goals and one of our messages to Congress is we want the full, what we call full funding, full use of the waterways trust fund. And just to add what Marianne said, it's a cost share. It's a 50-50 cost share. So our just say $120, $130 million, that's a $240 million a program, and we would like to see that money appropriated at a very minimum every year.
Steve, yeah. Please go ahead, and then I have a follow-up for you.
I was just going to say that, that $55 million that's been allocated right now to the Lower Mon project, we would expect that additional funds will be appropriated to other projects in the future from the trust fund dollars through what they call a work plan. Mm-hmm. It's not in the president's budget, but they would use a work plan allotment to continue work on other critical navigation structures within the portfolio of the Corps.
My quick follow-up to you, Steve, is this. How's the Army Corps of Engineers sort of prioritize the projects? This one absolutely has to be addressed next.
I talked briefly about that program, the condition assessment program we have. We send experts out to all the facilities at different points in time, and they look at those critical components that are that make up the locks and dams, and they make an assessment on those, whether it's a engineering judgment or physical measurements that are taken to determine this particular component is at high risk of failure. There's a likelihood of failure, and if it's at failure, it will close the lock or it'll delay traffic. And all of that gets put into a process, into a system, and then the things that are the highest risk bubble up to the top within our division, within our district, then within our division, and then nationwide. So when it gets to a point where it's too much, then we have to talk about recapitalization, and then we get into an authorization for a feasibility study to look at recapitalization.
Just how busy are our rivers? How busy is the Lower Mon? What sort of tonnage are we talking about? Maria?
Well, the last statistics out are for 2017, and we handle 27 million tons of freight, and that would be on the mainly on the Mon and the Ohio River.
Right, 27 million. Where are we heading? Is that up, down? What are we talking about here?
Definitely down. Up from 2016 by 5 million tons. So it has shown an increase, which is good. Probably a lot of it generated from the energy market. We don't have the actual breakdown of what those commodities are. But at our high point, we were at about 52 million tons. It used to be the number one inland river port. Right now, we're the number four inland river port. But Cincinnati added 200 miles of river, and the Huntington District added, you know, Ashland and South Point, so they made their regions a little bigger. So, yeah, Pittsburgh, I mean, each barge, people don't understand how much weight is in a barge, how much tonnage is in there, but that's approximately 60 to 72 truckloads on just one barge.
Peter, as a businessman and the head of Campbell Transportation, are you seeing a decline, an increase, you particularly?
Well, we're seeing from our company, actually, we've seen significant growth here the last couple of years, but we've been doing more business farther south, and we've been getting into new markets, moving new commodities. You know, you're clearly seeing a decrease in what I would call the utility steam coal. That's the coal-fired power plants. You've seen an uptick in metallurgic coal, and you're seeing a big energy renaissance. You know, the Shell cracker couldn't have been built where it is without the river system.
Right.
So you're seeing a kind of an energy renaissance going on in this region that's also reliant on the river.
Marianne, we see everybody sees the barges, and they see coal barges. Maybe we don't see as many as we used to, but we still see them. Briefly, what else is being transported along our rivers?
Petroleum. Aggregates, a lot of aggregates go in the river, and some scrap iron, raw materials.
Road salt.
A lot of road salt.
Mulch.
Lots of roads and mulch.
Scrap, you know, steel coils.
Right. Still mainly all bulk materials. It's still mainly all bulk cargo.
Okay, well, we have about 2 minutes left. So if the funds are approved, Steve, I'm sorry with you on this one. What's the timeline for the work?
If the funds are approved by an appropriations, we should have the Lower Mon project wrapped up in 2023. So that means we will have a new lock at Charleroi that's fully operational. We will have a brand new navigation channel in the river between Locks and Dam 3 at Elizabeth and Charleroi. And we'll remove Lock and Dam number 3, which would become a bottleneck at that point. So by 2023, or within 2023, we'll be getting over 90% of our project benefits.
Okay. Just a couple sentences from each of you. Bigger picture, you fix one key piece of the overall river transportation system, but what happens if you don't address other issues, upstream, downstream? Very briefly, we'll start with you, Peter.
Well, we, as Marianne said earlier, we are part of the system. Pittsburgh is at the end of the river system. We're the last major city along the Ohio River, certainly. And so a lot of the products that come in and out of Pittsburgh originate in the Gulf Coast down in the Houston area, especially the petroleum products. So we need a system that we can rely upon, not you know, more than just this particular area here in Pittsburgh.
Steve.
So the next thing on the horizon for the Corps of Engineers in Pittsburgh is the Upper Ohio Project. That's the next locks down from the Lower Mon, so it's Emsworth, Ashfields, and Montgomery. We have authorization there to do work at each one of those facilities to bring those up to standard and to continue reliable and safe navigation into the future. We are in the very beginning stages of that, and we want to get that funded as soon as possible to be efficient.
And you get the last 10 seconds, Marianne.
Well, we're looking forward. What we'd like to see happen is the Lower Mon complete and get those expertise workers right onto the Ohio River and make sure that we get safe locks and dams on Emsworth, Thresh, and Montgomery, because if those should shut down, the Pittsburgh pool would shut down.
Marianne Busey is Executive Director of the Port of Pittsburgh Commission. Peter Stefajic is Chair and CEO of Campbell Transportation Company. Steve Fritz is Mega Project Manager with the Army Corps of Engineers, Pittsburgh District. Thanks to all of you for being here today.
You're welcome, Thank you. Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
For taking an interest in our projects.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, we meet three members of the Blue Hots, a Pittsburgh band that creates music influenced by disparate genres, from decades-old jazz vocals to cocktail party-style instrumentals, with a strong dash of world music. Plus, what's the healthiest county in Pennsylvania? The least healthy. And what factors influence the overall health of communities and their residents? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Mick Stanelli, Joya Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.